The passage is Psalm 127. We're going to be spending the remainder of the summer in these psalms, particularly a few of these psalms that are referred to as the Psalms of Ascent. And last week, we looked at Psalm 121, and it's one of the first of the Psalms of Ascent. We're not going to be able to look at all of them, but we're going to pick out some selected Psalms of Ascent. And this morning, we're going to read Psalm 127. So if you're able, let me invite you to stand as I read this as a matter of respect for God's word. If you are not able, well, of course, then you can respect God in your heart as you sit as well. But I'm going to read this, and then when I'm done, I'm going to make the declaration that this is the word of the Lord and invite you to respond by saying, "Thanks be to God." Psalm 127. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. This is the word of the Lord. And may he write it on our hearts. Please be seated. The city of Edinburgh in Scotland has a town motto that was adopted in 1647. The town motto of Edinburgh is Nisi Dominus Frustra. Nisi Dominus Frustra, like all the best European town mottos, it's in Latin, of course. And it is a summary phrase taken directly from Psalm 127, verses 1 to 2, that captures actually the entire point of the psalm. Nisi Dominus Frustra. Nisi literally means if not, see, ni, if not, or you could say without or unless. Dominus means master or Lord, or frequently used in biblical terms as the Lord, Jehovah, Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And frustra is where we get the English word for frustrated or frustration, and it means vain, useless. And so you kind of see the way the motto fits, right? Nisi Dominus Frustra, without the Lord, vanity, or unless the Lord, frustration, or if not for the Lord, useless. The singer-songwriter Mark Schultz has a line in one of his songs that goes like this. He says, "I watched my days turn into years, and now I'm wondering how I wound up here. I dreamed my dreams, I made my plans, but all I built here is an empty man." Frustra, emptiness. Now there are two paths, I think, to emptiness, two paths to the same place. One is the path of constant motion. Right, frenetic activity, constant energy, always working, right? The stereotypical busy bee. The other path to emptiness is the path of constant leisure. I don't know if any of you remember from that old Disney cartoon, The Jungle Book, the cartoon movie. You have this bear. His name is Baloo, and he's giving advice to the little boy Mowgli. And he says, he looks at this at the busy bee, and he says, "Let me tell you, little britches," he says, "if you're acting like that bee acts, no, you're working too hard." Right? He's on the opposite end of the spectrum. You've got the bee, and you've got the bear. Now, there is some sense in which these two paths are stereotypical opposites. And neither of the stereotypes are good, right? The workaholic, on the one hand, who never sits still, and the lazy bum, on the other hand, who never does anything. Stereotypical opposites, but they're actually very similar in some important ways, because both of these stereotypes, the bee and the bear, they're both attempting to escape fear, and they're both attempting to find hope. In fact, they're both attempting in some ways to escape the same fear, and they're both attempting to find the same hope, but they're doing it nisi dominus. They're doing it without the Lord. Let me say it like this. Right? People on either side of this spectrum, bee and bear, as different as they may seem, are driven by a very similar sense of anxiety about the world around them. And they're looking, perhaps in different ways, but they're looking for true, lasting rest. They're looking to avoid the emptiness. Right? This is what I mean. If you're a bee person, right, then you're hyper aware of the danger of the world and the need to work hard to survive. In other words, the world around you is scary, and it is that fear, that scariness, that anxiety that drives your activity. Right? An activity that will, you hope anyway, that you hope is going to lead you someday, ultimately, to real rest. Now, if you're a bear person on the opposite end, then you're hyper aware of the stress that comes from constant activity, constant need to perform, and you react against that. In other words, the world around you is scary, and it is that fear, that anxiety, that drives you not to activity, but to inactivity. A pursuit of leisure that you hope anyway is actually going to at some point lead you to real rest. And the complicating factor is that neither work or rest is actually in and of itself sinful. In fact, we were made to do both and we're commanded to do both. Neither are sinful, both are commanded. The problem is that we don't use either work or rest in a way that was intended, which is why there's so much that's messed up with both of them in the world in which we live. The workaholic works to escape. The bum is lazy to escape. Both are seeking to escape from the anxiety, and both are looking for true, lasting rest. And if you tend to be a bee, then when you get anxious, your response will be to attack, to work the problem. And if you tend to be a bear, then your response when you get anxious will be to go to bed and pull up the covers. Now, let me ask you this question. Apply it to yourself. The stereotypes are stereotypes, right? No one's completely on either one of the spectrums. But most of us probably have a tendency. Which one is yours? Right? The bee or the bear? Some of you strongly gravitate to one or the other. Some of you, I know, some of you may have the balance perfectly struck. Right? You understand the point of the psalm. You don't need me to preach the rest of the sermon. But for the rest of us mortals, right? I think we can relate at least to the underlying sense of anxiety at times and the tendency that drives us in one or the other directions to be able to fight that. And so we need to look at this psalm. The basic idea for this morning is this, right? If you're just a summary phrase, right? We strive, we work or we rest, but we do it relentlessly looking for true rest, looking for true peace, and it always seems just beyond our grasp. Like just ahead of where we are, right? We were made to work, we were made to rest, but without the Lord, Nisi Dominus, without the Lord's work, without the Lord's blessing, all of our effort, whether it's in working or in resting, all of it is worthless and vain, frustra. Now, there's two headings that I have in the bulletin, and what they do is they correspond, if you're wondering as we kind of go through, they correspond to the two main sections of the psalm, verses 1 and 2, verses 3 to 5. In verses 1 and 2, we see God's ultimate control over all of our human efforts to build and to protect culture. In other words, we see God as central to our striving to be truly useful, to be productive. That's verses 1 and 2. Now, verses 3 to 5, we see God's ultimate control over the family and specifically children. In other words, we see God as central to our striving to be truly fruitful and leave a lasting legacy, right? Truly useful, truly fruitful. I'm not completely happy, to be honest. I'll just let you know with the titles, but they'll serve the purpose for what we have. The two sections of the psalm. So let's use them. Let's make a few observations, and then conclude by recognizing both the danger and the hope of what we're reading here. Nisi Dominus. All right, truly useful. Verses 1 and 2 again. Let me just read this, all right? Let's reorient ourselves. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. Now, Edinburgh, Scotland, I visited actually a couple of times for business years ago. I was never in either case there for very long, but you don't have to be in Edinburgh for very long to observe the prominence of one of the oldest castle fortresses in all of Europe. Edinburgh Castle is built on the top of a hill that completely dominates the landscape around it. It's extremely impressive. But all you have to do is take a quick read of history, and it will tell you how many times that castle has changed hands between warring parties. It was not an impregnable fortress. In fact, it appears impregnable, but it was captured many, many times, constantly passed back and forth, taken and retaken during the wars between the Scottish and the English, during the wars of political and religious conflict in Britain. So hence the appropriateness in 1647 when they adopted the motto, "Unless the Lord, vanity," because they realized no matter how big you build the house, no matter how mighty you construct the walls of the fortress, unless the Lord is in it, vanity. Right? You can build the biggest castle, construct the thickest walls, and it's not safe. It's an effort in vanity. Now, in verses 1 and 2, what you have are two of the primary activities of life in broad categories. You have the working to create things. This is what we do as people, as culture. The working to create things and the working to preserve them, creating and preserving them. And in both cases, without the Lord, they're useless and vain. In the beginning of verse 1, you see the creating, the building, and it's very clear in light of everything that we've already said, right? You can expend significant effort in building something, and it doesn't have to be a physical structure with concrete and cranes, right? It can be other things that you're looking to build in your life, right? Certain goals that you have. But if the Lord is not in it, then whatever you build is not going to last. That's what it's clearly saying in verse 1. Now, similarly, at the end of verse 1, you see this universal occupation of preserving. Not just building, but after something is built, watching over it, caring for it, protecting it. And just like with the building itself, with the work itself, right, it's not a bad thing, right? We were made to be stewards. We were made to take care of and preserve things. Humanity was created to be builders, to make things as image bearers of the God who created the heavens and the earth. And similarly, we were made to be stewards, to be keepers of what God has made, to watch over it and to protect it. It's embedded in the very creation story, right? In Genesis 1 and 2, God comes to Adam and commands him. He says, this is what you are to do. You are to chabad and shamar. Those are the Hebrew words. You are to cultivate and to keep, to develop and to protect. That's what verse 1's talking about here. The problem is not with the building itself, that's commanded. The problem is not with the watching over, that's commanded, right? Just like the problem for an athlete is not with the competing itself, it's the who is in it. What is the source of what you do? What is the foundation of what you do? And we'll see that on display in the next couple of weeks if you watch any of the Olympics, right? It's Olympics time, so time to pull out one of my favorite illustrations from Chariots of Fire, that relatively old movie. Now, about the true story of two English runners in the 1924 Paris Olympics. One, to Christians, is a very famous guy, Eric Little, the son of missionaries himself, who has that line in the movie. You've probably heard it quoted if you've been around church, because it's frequently quoted in churches, right? That line in the movie when he's explaining why, even though he knows he's called, even though he plans to go back to China as a missionary, why he's going to continue first competitive running. He says, "I believe God made me for a purpose. I know it. Right? He made me for China. But he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure." He says, to give it up, that is to give up competitive running at this point in this moment in time, he says, to give it up would be to hold God in contempt. It's not just fun for me, he says. To win is to honor him. It's interesting. The foundation and the reason, the goal of why he's running. It's not whether you build or whether you protect, it's why. It's not whether you run or whether you compete, it's why. Now, in contrast, Little's Olympic teammate, Harold Abrahams, who just before his biggest 100-meter race of his life, the biggest race of his life, he too is reflecting on why he's doing what he's doing. But by contrast, this is what Abraham says. He says, he's thinking about it, and he says, "In 1 hour's time, I'm going to be out there again. I will raise my eyes, and I will look down that corridor, 4 feet wide, with 10 lonely seconds to justify my existence." As he's anticipating his race, that's what he's thinking about. The lonely corridor, 4 feet wide and 10 seconds to justify my existence. You see the difference? Both men run. Both men were fast. But little knew that the Lord was the source of his speed and the owner of his speed. And as a result, the purpose of his running or not running was to bring glory to God. Right? He was content. Now, Abraham's, in contrast, he worked hard, but his hard work was like the anxious toil it talks about in verse 2. Nisi Dominus Frustra. Frustra. So that's the first point. To be truly useful, to find the contentment and the true rest that all of us long for, you need to recognize the Lord as both the source and the goal of your efforts. Now, second part, verses 3 to 5, how to be truly fruitful. What you have here, actually, in verses 3 to 5, is in the entirety of this psalm, the third of the three major life preoccupations. All right, we've got building, we occupy ourselves with that. We have preserving what we built, we occupy ourselves with that. And now we have raising the next generation. Right? Whether you individually are a parent or a grandparent yourself, this is what we are about as a society, as a major occupation. We look to the future and we take steps to try to leave a legacy, to raise children, to not just live for our time, but to be fruitful for time forward. Look again at verses 3 to 5. Let's just read it again. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. Okay? Children are the fruit of a society. The lasting, the regenerative product of our culture. And the theme fits here in verses 3 to 5, though the approach, instead of being negative, unless the Lord, that's verses 1 and 2. The approach switches to more positive from negative, but it's exactly the same, right? Because the overarching idea holds, without understanding the Lord as the source and the goal of raising children, the effort is going to be frustration. It's going to be vanity. It says in verse 3 that children are a heritage from the Lord. Right? A heritage, an inheritance. And this gets to the question of where do your children come from and to whom do your children really belong? Our children are an inheritance of the Lord or from the Lord. And there's debate about how you would actually translate that. Are they from the Lord? In other words, they're our inheritance, or are they of the Lord? They're his inheritance. One way or the other, wherever you kind of find yourself in the debate about the Hebrew preposition, one way or the other, what is absolutely true is whether it is an inheritance that is given to you or it is an inheritance of the Lord's. One way or the other, they're ours to care for here, but they belong ultimately and come from ultimately the Lord. Right? They're also an instrument of the Lord. Verse 4, like arrows in the hands of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Right? They are an instrument. They are to be used for a purpose. And they are, verse 5, a blessing of the Lord. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full. Now, all these ideas overlap. Right? An inheritance of the Lord, an instrument of the Lord, a blessing of the Lord. Children, the future generation, like our watching, like our building, they all come from the Lord, and the goal is the Lord. And like we said, this doesn't negate the command for us to cultivate and keep. Right? That applies equally to raising children. Again, whether they're your own or part of a covenant community in which we exist here as a church. Parents, teachers, churches, they have real responsibility to children, to teach, to train, to show, to cultivate, to keep, to build into them character, to preserve and to protect, all of those things, but they do not belong ultimately to us. And I got to tell you, this is a real struggle for many parents, this one included. Interesting observation. I told you we're going to have next Sunday night a hymn sing, and we got lots of requests. Right? I think we have more than, some of them overlapped, obviously, but just an individual, I think we have more than 50 songs that were suggested for us to sing next Sunday night. Now, we're not going to sing all of them. We can't, right? Right? But more than 50 songs. Now, here's what I found interesting. Not one of them was the famous Francis Havergal song, Take My Life and Let It Be. Not one of them. Very famous song. Very, very popular hymn. Take My Life and Let It Be. Not one of those, not one of those suggestions was that song. And I'm not being critical. I sympathize. It's an extremely scary song. Right? In fact, actually, I even feel like, I mean, when we worship, we're planning services, if we ever sing that song, I almost feel bad assigning it because it's as if you're commanding the people to lie. Right? You know, if you've been reading, maybe you know the words. Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. Take my moments and my days, let them flow in ceaseless praise. And it goes on from there. This is the most convicting. This gets down to it. Take my love, Lord, I pour. At thy feet its treasure store. Take myself and I will be ever only all for thee. Is that the prayer of your heart? I mean, honestly, at most times, I mean, it is if we know what the right thing to say is, but that's a scary song to sing. Ever only all for thee. Take it, Lord. It's yours. Belongs to you. Comes from you. And it's true enough. That's exactly what God asks of us. But it is a scary prayer to pray. And God asks of us that same thing when it comes to our children. Sinclair Ferguson, another Scot, there's kind of a Scottish theme this morning. Right, Sinclair Ferguson actually goes so far as to suggest another verse to the song. Right? As a reminder, he says, for what his attitude ought to be as a parent. Right? He just adds to the scariness of the song for me. This is what if he could add a verse, this is what he said he would add to the song. Take my daughter and my son, in them both thy will be done. To thee alone I now them give, may they for thy glory live. You hear that? Take my daughter and my son, in them both thy will be done. To thee alone I now them give, may they for thy glory live. Now, you can hear that in one of two ways. Either is incredibly terrifying, or really, if you really understand it, is incredibly freeing. And like I said, I can relate to the terrifying, because the thought of admitting that there is a work that I cannot do in my children is terrifying to a person who likes to be in control of all things. Right? Lessons I can't teach. Change that I can't engineer, circumstances that I can't construct, life decisions that I can't make for them. That's scary in a sense. But on the other hand, a prayer like that is a recognition of nisi dominus frustram, unless the Lord vanity. And in that recognition, there is incredible freedom because it acknowledges what we know all along, that we have no power to build, no power to maintain anything that is lasting in the lives of our children unless the Lord builds that house. So to turn over the task to the only truly qualified one who is able to do it, and that is the Lord himself, is maybe at the beginning slightly terrifying, but it actually is the only incredibly freeing way to be truly fruitful. Psalm 127 that we've been reading says in the superscription that this is a song of Solomon. And there's a couple of clues in the psalm itself that internally testify to that fact, that support that fact. For example, in verse 2, just a little kind of point here. In verse 2, it says that God gives his beloved sleep. Now that word there, his beloved, that actually is the same word that God gives to Solomon as his personal name back in 2 Samuel chapter 12. Right? When God gives through the prophet the name for Solomon, that's the name that he was given, Jedidiah, right? My beloved. Now, perhaps the most obvious thing, though, in this psalm that points us to the fact that this is, in fact, a song of Solomon, is that it starts with a building metaphor, right? Unless the Lord builds the house. And Solomon, of course, is the king who built the great temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, right? David, his father, had envisioned the temple, but it was Solomon's job to actually be the builder. Then you have the metaphor of the watchman, the second half of verse 1 that we were talking about, and Solomon was the one who was to be a caretaker as well, a keeper of the United Kingdom. David, his father, was the one who had, right, after Saul had sort of started it, but under a godly king, David was the one who had brought the kingdom together and unified it, established a capital in Jerusalem. It was Solomon's job then to watch over it, to keep it, to guard it. There's also the idea, right, the metaphor of a godly heritage of, of children. Remember, Solomon was not David's firstborn son, and yet God chose him to continue the royal line, the line that through his children would ultimately lead to the promised Messiah. This is very appropriately a psalm of Solomon. And yet, if you think about it, and you think about it in the context of Solomon and in Solomon's life, there's also a very sobering warning in the fact that this is Solomon's psalm. Because in one way or another, Solomon messed up or failed in parts of each of those roles that he was given as builder, as keeper, as father. As a builder, if you go back and read the accounts, he had all kinds of labor disputes, and he failed to listen to counsel about how to rightly build the temple. As a keeper, the United Kingdom of Israel, it didn't last past his own generation. Right? Split with his sons. His family life, despite all of his wisdom, was terrible. Right? More women in his life than you could count. But you scratch your head and you say, wait a minute, but Solomon had all the answers, right? I mean, he literally wrote the book of wisdom. He's the author of Psalm 127, right? He had all the answers. Yeah, he did. Yes, he did. And yet he still struggled. He still faltered. He still failed. And yet in that is where the real hope is. Because here, in that failure that we can all recognize, wait a minute, you mean you're saying I could have all the right answers and I could still fail? Yes, actually, yes. But that's where the hope is. That's where the telescope to the gospel is. And I credit my brother, David, with actually helping me see how this flows right from Psalm 127. If you follow me on social media, you saw earlier this week that I said you'd probably be better off listening to his sermon on Psalm 127 than mine. But at least for this morning, this is the Reverend Har you have, so tough. But let me try to show you what he showed me. There is a temptation to look at this psalm and conclude that it is purely conditional. In other words, that it's purely directed to you and to me. Right? If the Lord builds, then we have success, but if he doesn't, if you don't let him build, vanity. Right? If you let the Lord be the watchman, then you have success, but if you don't, well then, vanity. Right? If you let the Lord be the center of your parenting, then reward comes, blessing comes, but if you don't, then shame. And as it relates to us, there is a proverbial kind of feel to Psalm 127. Remember, Solomon's the one who wrote the Proverbs, godly principles that form the basis of living well in the world. And so 127, Psalm 127, a Psalm of Solomon, it has a certain proverbial feel to it. And there is wisdom, right? We should seek the Lord to be involved in all of our activities. But all of these things that are for us somewhat conditional in our day-to-day living, they are ultimately and completely unconditionally fulfilled by God himself in Jesus Christ. In other words, God intends and intended from the very beginning to be for his people what his people can never be. He intends to be for them the builder and the building itself. He intends to be the watcher and the provider of rest. He intends to be, through Jesus Christ, the son who rises up to honor his father by defeating his father's enemies. Unless the Lord builds the house. But guess what? He did. Remember earlier this year, if you were here earlier this year, we looked at 2 Samuel. And in 2 Samuel chapter 7, when David told God that he wanted to build the temple, I want to build you a house, he said to God. And God said through the prophet Nathan, no. Nope, David, you're not going to build me a house. Actually, what's going to happen is I'm going to build you a house. Now, David was just thinking purely in physical terms, building God a physical temple. But what God was saying back to him was, no, you're not going to build me a house. That's for your son to build the physical temple. But David, actually, there is a house that's going to be built, and I'm going to be the one who builds it. I'm going to build you a house. I'm going to build you a dynasty. I'm going to build you a lineage. And this was a common understanding of that word. God was going to build a house for David from which, he says in 2 Samuel 7, his steadfast love would never depart. A lineage, a house, a dynasty that would lead to an eternal king, a king who would sit on the throne of David forever. Unless the Lord builds the house. Well, guess what? It's a condition that turns into a promise because he did. A house that leads us right to Jesus. And Jesus is not just the fulfillment of that dynasty. He is himself the ultimate temple. He is the ultimate house. John 2, actually saying this, gets Jesus into some trouble when he says it, because he's walking around the temple and he's chasing out the crooked money changers who were desecrating the place of worship. And the religious leaders challenge him. They say, what authority do you have to be doing what you're doing? And he makes this comment. He says, destroy this house, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And when he says that, and John, in writing it, even kind of notes in his parenthetical note, Jesus is talking not about the physical structure around them, he's talking about his body. Blasphemy, the leaders cry. They all yell out, right? Because the temple is the house where God lives. Exactly. Right. Jesus means to communicate exactly that. I am the Lord's house. And he's the builder. Right? The living house of God today is his church. Whose church? Jesus' church. Matthew 16, 18, Jesus tells Peter that on the rock of the gospel message that he has just proclaimed, Jesus says, I am going to build my church. And that's not conditional. The church will be built. The house will be built. Jesus will build it. And the gates of hell, he says, shall not prevail against us. He's the builder, and he's the building. He's also the watchman of the city. The city of Jerusalem in Solomon's day was a physical structure, right? A physical city, a physical sign of God's ruling presence of his kingdom. But with the coming of Jesus, that city is now a heavenly one, a heavenly one to which the historical city of Jerusalem pointed us. The historical kingdom ruled at Jerusalem was broken apart after Solomon, ultimately conquered. But in the New Testament letter to the Hebrews, the writer says that we now have come to Mount Zion and the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. And who watches over that Jerusalem? The people of God? Who watches? The Lord does. Remember last week, Psalm 121? Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber or sleep. It's not conditional. He who keeps, the same word that's used in Psalm 127 here. Keeps, watches, it's the same Hebrew word. He who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. Right? He's the one who keeps. He's also the one who gives rest. Psalm 127, verse 2. The Lord gives to his beloved sleep. And Jesus, in Matthew 11:28, says, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Where does the rest come from? It comes from Jesus. Unless the Lord gives, unless the Lord provides, he has. And that's exactly what Jesus does, watching over the heavenly Jerusalem, the residents of the city, the people that are under his care. Now, let me close with one essential truth and one practical suggestion. One essential truth. Jesus is able to be all of these things for us in the midst of our failure to meet the conditions. He's able to be all of these things for us because of what he did and because of the sleep that he experienced himself. At the work of perfect obedience in his life, meeting all the conditions of the law, and the sleep that he experienced in his death on the cross. I don't want you to miss this. This actually, I'm indebted to the Anglican Bishop of Lincoln, Christopher Wordsworth, in the early 1800s. He wrote about this, and Charles Spurgeon picked up on it. He observed that when God wanted to give a precious gift to his beloved Adam in the Garden of Eden, in the creation, when he wanted to give a gift to Adam, he caused Adam to sleep, and he brought forth from his side Eve, the mother of all the living. In the same way, but even more amazingly, Wordsworth says, while Jesus Christ, the second Adam, the true Jedediah, the well-beloved Son of God, right? When Jesus Christ, the second Adam, was sleeping in his death on the cross, God formed from him in his death and by his death, even by the life-giving streams flowing from his own precious side, he gave him the church. He gave to his beloved a gift, the church, the spiritual Eve, the mother of all living, and he gave her to him as his bride. You see what he's saying? from the sleep of Jesus, from his death, the church was formed. The people of God, under the rule of God, built up into a building with Jesus Christ himself as the foundation. Now, one practical suggestion about what this means for your own rhythm of work and rest. My brother called it sleeping the gospel and working the gospel. Here's how it works. If Jesus already did what he did, the work that he accomplished, and he perfectly accomplishes and will accomplish what he has said he's going to do, and that is build his people into an eternal church who will be his beautiful bride, and he guarantees it by his work on the cross, then when you rehearse that truth in the midst of your day, you will be able to lie down at night and really sleep. My brother actually suggests, I think this is a great idea. You know, in the Jewish practice, the day started the night before. Right? Beginning with the evening and sleep. Now, this isn't, I think you can stretch this too far or whatever, but the concept in terms of the way that you mentally approach your rest, start there. Ever thought about that? Instead of ending your day with rest as if it's the last thing, begin with rest, begin with sleep, and consider it as an act of worship before you do anything with your next day. You are acknowledging that the Lord is the Lord of the universe. Right? Sleep is an act of worship. Have you ever thought about that? Right? We spend a quarter to a third of our lives curled up, basically recognizing that we are limited beings. It's an act of recognition. And the world, while we spend those hours curled up in a little ball, like a little baby, the world continues to spin on its axis. Start your day recognizing that it is the Lord who is in control of all things. Let your sleep be an act of worship. Now, at the and flowing right from that, right? In turn, when you wake up in the morning and you work hard in whatever God has called you to do, you can work now with the freedom of knowing it isn't up to me. It actually frees you to be able to work hard, but to do it with a different foundation and to do it with a different goal. Your work isn't an escape. Your rest isn't an escape. They're both acts of worship. There's another spot in the movie Chariots of Fire where Abraham's laughs at the idea of being content, right? You had Little and Abraham's, these two different portrayals of what it means to run and compete. And Abraham says in this other spot, he's sort of laughing at the idea of ever being able to be content. And he says, contentment? He said, I'm 24 years old and I have never known it. I am forever in pursuit and I don't even know what I'm chasing. Forever in pursuit and not even aware of what you're chasing. And that, probably better than anything else, cuts to the true hell of the vanity that's being described in verses 1 to 2. A life of being forever in pursuit when you don't even know what you're looking for. Nisi Dominus Frustra. But with the Lord, not without the Lord, but with the Lord, you have a foundation for your work and your rest. You have a focus for your work and your rest. And you have a freedom in both your work and in your rest. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the freedom that comes from acknowledging that you are the Lord who made all things, upholds and protects all things, and will bring all things to their rightful place and their rightful conclusion. Lord, I pray that would penetrate each of our anxious hearts this morning. And some of us may be feeling it more acutely today, and some of us feel great today and will experience the anxiety tomorrow or next week or next month. Lord, allow these truths to penetrate deep into our hearts so that when the moment comes, we aren't afraid, we aren't surprised, but we know exactly what to do with them. We take them to you, we confess them to you, and we lean on your promises to be what we can never be. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.